美国海军陆战队成立于1775年11月10号，今年是249周年。美国海军陆战队参与了多场重大战役，包括朝鲜战争早期的长津湖战役。虽然毛泽东当时发动人海战术，下令中共第九兵团消灭美国海军陆战队一师，但是美军重创共军，突破重围，安全撤离到南部。南撤过程中，后面还跟随着将近10万逃离北朝鲜的难民。长津湖一战被视为美国近代军事历史的一个重要篇章。美国之音记者燕青最近采访了1950年参加长津湖战役的美国海军陆战队员，也和关注亚太局势的海军陆战队退役上校格兰特·纽山姆一起回顾那场战役，以及美国海军陆战队成立200多年以来的演变。
Welcome to VOA, Colonel Newsham.
I'm glad to be here.
An early happy Marine Corps birthday to you.
Oh, that's right. Well, thank you very much.
The Marine Corps was founded in 1775. What were the circumstances?
Oh, well, the sort of soon-to-be independent American colonies needed Marines to support the Navy. Now, back then, when you had Navy ships sail around, you needed Marines to basically go ashore and do things, do ground operations.Also, when you fought other ships, the Marines would sometimes man guns, but would also operate up in the masts and shoot down on other ships, lead boarding parties as well. So it's a necessary sort of adjunct to naval operations. The Americans realized they needed it, so they put out the call for recruits. The legend is that it was recruited in a bar.In Philadelphia called Tun Tavern. It's probably mostly true. Tun Tavern is long gone, but there's apparently some move afoot by some former Marines to rebuild it and I guess make a national shrine out of it. Maybe in some way the Marines reflect this American character of sort of independence and not being liking to be told they can't do something. There is a sense that when Marines do set out on a mission, that they'll succeed. Of course, that isn't always the case, and sometimes it costs lives, costs many more lives than it should. But that is a sort of moral strength. That's an ethos in the Marine Corps that you...
I'm told that it is precisely this special Marine Corps ethos that led...the United States Marine Corps and the 1st Marine Division, to be specific, to fight its way out at Charleston Reservoir in November, December 1950, at the beginning of the Korean War. So, and I'm told that the Charleston Reservoir campaign, together with the battle in World War I you referred to at Belleau Wood, and then the other famous battle,in World War II, Iwo Jima, Charleston Reservoir Campaign is the third most famous battle in Marine Corps history. Tell us something about it.
The Charleston Reservoir fight was one that, to me, it's one of the most extraordinary accomplishments by Marines of all ranks to have gotten out of there more or less intact with the enemy that was trying to stop them in ruins or in tatters, and that despite the odds being overwhelmingly against them. The short sort of explanation for that campaign, that fight, is that after the Americans had turned the tide on the Korean Peninsula, I think you could fairly say one person. I think you're holding his book. That's General O.P. Smith, Oliver P. Smith, and he was the commander of the 1st Marine Division.And at the time, from Incheon up to, and then up to that drive north. And you remember that I said everyone else had irrational exuberance, like Warren Buffett would have said. He was cautious. He knew not to go along with the crowd, with the popular thinking, and even with orders that he was being given by higher headquarters to get with the program and head north as fast as you could. Instead, he moved at a rate that allowed him to establish supply bases and also to have his units close enough that if necessary, they could mutually reinforce each other instead of getting strung out. And a friend of mine whose father was involved in all of this said that this was in his entire Marine Corps career, this is as close as he had ever seen any Marine officer of any rank come to disobeying orders. And Smith, he was able to withstand this pressure, mental pressure, the browbeating that comes of being, you know, you're slow, you guys aren't, you know, with it. And he withstood it. And as a result, he put the 1st Marine Division in a position where they could withstand the initial Chinese assault and then withdraw and, well, fight their way to the rear. And this being, despite being surrounded by, I forget the exact number, but say 5 Chinese divisions. And a division is a big deal. And the Marines fought their way through. And it was because of his foresight, and I say that willingness to go against the grain, and because this was his sense of what was right, what was prudent. And he was very experienced by that point as well. He had been the assistant division commander on Peleliu. The division commander himself was not particularly impressive and did not perform very well, but the assistant division commander, General Smith, did very well. And he had been in, I believe, the additional fighting down in the Solomons as well. So he was a very experienced officer and kept his wits about him. And he had a very good staff and also had very good Marines down to the most junior ones. And that generally reflects the guy at the very top as well. He's not well known today, which is unfortunate.
President Xi Jinping of China, in a very famous speech about the Korean War delivered a few years ago, he described the war as a huge Chinese success. And he said, the Chinese side won because they had higher spirits than the Americans. And the Americans had more steel, but a lot less spirit compared to the Chinese. What do you say about that?
Well, that's what he has to say. But in terms of the Chinese winning, well, there's a famous map. It's a picture you see from outer space, and it has the southern half of the Korean Peninsula, which is bright lights everywhere at night. Up north, there's nothing. Well, that's not exactly a great victory. We've had these kind of regimes, the authoritarians, the dictators, the countries which wouldn't dare have a popular election or an honest one, claim the Americans are weak. Use Hitler and Joseph Goebbels, his propaganda minister, claimed the Americans were playboys, didn't have the nerve for a fight. The Japanese thought we were weak and effeminate, and that the Japanese Yamato Damashi, fighting spirit, would prevail. Well, look what happened in 1945. The Germans were occupied and the Wehrmacht was exterminated by and large. The same thing with the Japanese. Talk about underestimating your opponent and what free people can do, I think. And even in the Korean War, the Chinese wanted much to do with the Marines. Marines have a distinctive uniform. And when they realized the Marines up against them, they were not very, very happy about that. But that's what, I say, these kind of people always say. But look at the track record. Even bin Laden thought that he was the strong horse, the Americans were decadent, and that he was going to win. Well, look at him. He went into hiding almost immediately after 9/11, spent the next 10 years sort of hidden in a house that the Pakistanis probably provided to him. And then he got, the SEALs showed up one day and shot him. You underestimate what free people will do to defend themselves when they feel afraid. And this has been, these kind of people have been doing it for a long time. You can say the Marines are weak, or the U.S. is weak. And that people have been saying it, but have they ever been right? When it comes to a fight, people tend to underestimate what free people are capable of. And it's not just the Marines, but it's, of course, that's what we're talking about today, but that's every U.S. service. The Imperial Japanese Navy all got sunk by the U.S. Navy. And Air Force, well, there wasn't much of a Japanese Air Force left. And same thing in the Korean War and the Chosin Reservoir exam as well. Yes, in sort of geographic terms, the war settled into a stalemate because when the Americans didn't want to go do what was necessary to take the whole thing. But look at it now. You've been able, because of that, look at that war, you've turned South Korea into one of the most successful economies on earth, representative democracy. It's everything China is not. And because of the sacrifices made by Americans, Commonwealth, and other free nations, and the South Korean people themselves, who wanted nothing to do with that system, that ought to tell you something. And look at what, after the Korean War, look at what China experienced. Well, it wasn't a very good time. You had the famines, the Cultural Revolution. Until not so long ago, it was a place where it was really impoverished. And now it's just impoverished, but with a nice veneer.
Back in 1950, it was true that the United States, the Marines were supported by air power, etc., that the Chinese didn't have. But today, you and others have warned that the Chinese are really arming themselves to the teeth, mm-hmm. like they often used to describe the Americans. So China has a lot more steel now, mm-hmm. and steel got a huge population advantage. That, what kind of challenge does that pose to the United States? And what is the Marine Corps and the United States doing to take on this challenge? Mm-hmm. What ought it to do?
Yeah, well, you'd earlier mentioned the criticism, almost as an excuse for defeat, that you used to hear from the Germans and the Japanese and others, that, well, the Americans used artillery. They had so much sort of material resources. They had aircraft and bombs and more than you could count. Thus, we lost. But we have really, the claim is, but fighting spirit, well, we had it. Well, look at the results. But you're right, the Chinese have developed, they've put together a military that is impressive. And they've done it very quickly. And the I think it's important for us not to underestimate really the industriousness of the Chinese people, which in the communist regime has in some ways tapped into simply by not starving and killing them and giving them a little bit of freedom. But the People's Liberation Army is impressive in some respects. It has a long way to go. But nonetheless, in a short time, it's come very far and quickly. And it's, you know, we've seen this before. You know, once again, you know, the Germans, the Russians, you know, they come and go. And ultimately, these are regimes that are not based on the idea of freedom, consensual government. So it is possible to really create a military that looks good and does have some real capabilities. But at the same time, it's missing something. I would say it's missing spirit, actually. But this is something that the Americans need to take very seriously and to make sure that our own military advantage does not deteriorate. And we did for too long. You remember after the end of history, remember the Cold War fell, and the idea was, well, democracies have won, there will never be another war again, we don't have anything to worry about, nobody will ever be our equal. Well, that's dangerous thinking, and we're paying for it now, so we have to get our wits to collect our wits about us and rebuild the military. Need a bigger Navy, need a bigger Air Force, need more defense spending, and you need to realize that you're already at war. The other side tells us they're at war. It's not a shooting war. It's not a kinetic war, but from a Chinese concept of warfare, they very much are at war with us. So that everything starts from having that understanding. Additionally, military might comes very often from economic power, economic prosperity. And the Chinese economy is very much like a Ponzi scheme, in that if you took away the convertible currency, the dollars, the euros that have been poured into the place, along with technology and know-how, China would be nowhere near what it is. And that's a huge vulnerability. So ideally, the Americans would wise up and stop funding the country that says it wants to destroy them. And if you do that, well, then Beijing will have the choice between building a navy or giving flush toilets to more of its citizens, or doing something about the 600 million Chinese who live on less than $5 a day. Give them that choice, guns or butter. But you can't have both in this case. But I do want to stress, and every year the Department of Defense puts out a very good report on Chinese military power. It's worth looking at. And sometimes you do have to step back and really be impressed with what the PRC has accomplished. At the same time, if they try to project power too far beyond the Chinese mainland, that they're going to have some real problems. They understand the difficulty and are trying to correct it. But it's really up to the democracies, to the free nations, to see if they are going to get together and actually defend the idea of freedom.
On that point, is the United States, the Marine Corps, engaged with our partners and allies in Asia? You have experience working in that part of the world.
Oh, very much. The Marines have, fortunately, they've in recent years, that we have started to rediscover Asia. We've always been there, and there's always been Marines operating there. But now it's a priority theater. And you find Marines operating from Korea to Japan, down to the Philippines in large numbers now. Throughout Southeast Asia, they're regularly conducting exercises. They've been in Indonesia recently, Malaysia as well. They're in Australia 6 months of the year, in northern Australia, conducting exercises, not just with themselves, but with partner nations. And we don't force anybody to train with us, to exercise with us. It's people want to do it. And it's very much, as I said, a priority theater. You find that the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force in California is now really focused on Asia. And that is a big unit, a big force. So now you've got that to add into the Marines who are stationed on Okinawa, who operate up from the Northern Pacific. The Marines and the Americans are paying more attention to the Central Pacific as well, to the Pacific Islands. So you see just more of a Marine presence throughout the region. They could use more transport, could use more amphibious ships, of course. They could always use more locations from which to operate, but they're doing a good job getting closer, for example, to the Japanese, to the Filipinos, and now it's a very mutually beneficial relationship between the Marines and the Philippine Armed Forces. You've even got some Marines on Taiwan advising and helping out. Australia, very good relationship with them. So the Marines, I say, fortunately, have no longer so fixated on the Middle East, on Afghanistan and Iraq, but now they really are looking at the Pacific, trying to think of new operating concepts as, in addition to the traditional ones that they've got. So you always try to look at things from the other side's perspective. And would you, if you were looking at it from Beijing, would you like to have Marines all over the place in the Pacific? It causes you some problems, obviously.
The depiction of Marines, even in the United States, I mean, not to mention the Chinese official media, they paint the Marines as a group of people with muscular strength. You know, a lot more, what's the word, brawn, mm-hmm. than brain. But you were trying to emphasize the point in our conversations that in the Marine Corps, in fact, both the brawn, the muscle, and the brain are equally important. Can you say something more about that?
Well, yeah, but you've got, if all you have is sort of bulging biceps and tattoos, well, you wouldn't have won. You wouldn't have this track record of success. And it requires ultimately the mental toughness is the thing. And if you look at most Marines, if you can get to a group of them, actually they're not that big. By and large, there are some who are, but it's surprising actually just how slender a lot of them are. And that you look at pictures of the old, say, 1st Marine Division in World War II. And these guys are not what you'd call bulked up, but very normally sized, normally proportioned people. But there's this mental business bit that goes with it. And that really is the key to a lot of it, is this mental toughness. Because without the mind to move it, the body doesn't do much. And if you hang around Marines, man, you'll find that they are incredibly practical and can get things done. In fact, I used to use as my example, I would say, look, you could take any, if you say took 20 Marines, and really of all ranks, and you said, does anyone here know the formula for turning water into gasoline? I'll bet you a hand comes up. There's always somebody who knows how to get something done. And it's they don't hire, they don't let in stupid people. But the image, of course, is, you know, sort of doltish, dangerous boneheads. But that's exactly wrong. It really is. And General Smith was, of course, considered an intellectual, actually. But this was a guy that lived through three major campaigns. And so you combine a very intelligent guy with a guy who knew how to get stuff done and motivate Marines to get things done. And he made the best use of his staff, which was excellent. But it was all the way down to the junior Marine walking point, trying to get through the Chinese lines, that it's from top to bottom. You have this ethos that you're not going to lose. And that is something that is very tough to deal with if you're an enemy of freedom.
So to sum up what Colonel Newsham has to say about the Marine Corps, look at the results. Is that right?
At the end of the day, that's what matters. Nobody cares if you look good in dress uniforms, if you put on a good parade, if you look the part. What matters is if you win, and nothing else does. Yes, it's good to have all those other things, and sometimes those can help you help you win by, if you look at it as a manifestation of precision, discipline, commitment, and attention to detail, all of which is extremely important. If that's what you use it for, it can be very useful. But at the end of the day, it's do you succeed on the battlefield? And that's where, say, Marines' top leaders have the highest responsibility. There's never been a problem at the junior levels, the younger officers and throughout the enlisted ranks. It's more at the higher levels where you have even greater responsibility not to waste Marine lives, to employ them properly. And that is something that always needs to be judged. And, others can make their own assessments of that. But the higher you get, the more important it is to ensure that you're making the best use of this wonderful resource that the nation has. But as I said, did you succeed? Sometimes these days we find that senior officers look a bit like Marshal Zhukov himself. Which war did you win? And then you look at, say, a General Smith in his uniform, and he might have two. So it is something that we do need to be very careful about is, are we performing to the highest sort of possible level?
What were some of the major milestones of the Corps between 1775 and today?
Well, they've always been in service to the country. It's often been with the Navy. It's often been in far-flung places. China, for example, for many years. You had them serving Guam, Central America, Haiti, Santo Domingo, the so-called banana wars of the 1920s. But they've pretty much been everywhere Americans have gone. And it's always been, the Navy that played such a role in sort of spreading America's influence, its presence. And the Marines were always there with them, performing their function, their role. But it was really the Spanish-American War when you started to hear about the Marines more regularly, even though they did participate in every war the Americans fought up until then, Mexican-American War, the Seminole Wars against the Indians down in Florida, the Civil War. There were Marines on both sides, actually. But it was Spanish-American War where they played a role and got some notice, particularly in Cuba. And then World War I came along, and that's where the Marines really got bigger, got more famous, in effect. They fought in France and were very famous for one particular battle called Belleau Wood, where they assaulted some well-defended German positions, defended by machine guns, and the Marines prevailed. It was a bloodbath, but they prevailed. And that got press attention, got public attention. And that, some might say, is that was one of the things that really sort of supercharged the Marines and their reputation. The Germans referred to them, according to legend, as Teufelhunden, as devil dogs, and which is by any measure a ferocious kind of moniker. And
the Marines love that moniker.
They kind of do. They will still refer to themselves sometimes by that expression. But that was World War I, and say it got the Marines on a scale, and that made them even more useful. And there's obviously their usefulness in sort of extended ground combat was something to note. And then World War II came along, and that's where the Marine Corps really expanded just hugely. It went from a very small force to a very big one. But the Marines had also spent the interwar years, one, fighting some wars down in Central America, but also developing the amphibious capabilities that they would employ in the Pacific to defeat the Japanese. And the Pacific is where the Marines did really make their mark with battles from Guadalcanal to Peleliu, to Saipan, Guam, Okinawa, Iwo Jima. Now, these are words that people don't know history so much these days, but for people of my era, everybody knew those words. My parents, all of them, but my parents and their friends, everybody knew those words, and you would hear it. It was just a synonym for real bloody fighting, but also the Americans, the Marines coming out on top. I will note the Army did play a major role in the Pacific too. It wasn't just the Marines, but they did play a very important, probably a decisive role in that fight. And then everyone thought, well, the big wars are done for a good long while. And then just a few years later, after World War II, the Korean War started. And the Marines were called up and went into the fray immediately. And it's quite a story how they organized themselves. Sometimes just units did it on their own. Got to the West Coast, trained as necessary, and deployed very, very quickly to the Korean Peninsula.
Well, initiative is one of the qualities that the Marine Corps is proud of itself, isn't it?
It is. Mm-hmm. That's the idea, is that you're supposed to show initiative. And that goes down to the lowest level, lowest ranks as well. You'll often hear sometimes, actually, with young lieutenants, people say good initiative, but poor judgment. But you want people to take the initiative. You don't want them to just sit around until someone tells them what to do. And there's a very practical matter to that is, one, just the nature of operations is that you will find people who don't have somebody above them telling them what to do. And we expect them to understand the situation, to take charge and actually do something. And also there's the experience, say, particularly of World War II, where just about everyone else was dead. So you would have some very junior Marines who were all that was left, and you would expect them to take over. And that is pretty much ingrained in Marines to this day. Of course, after the Korean War, about 10 years later, you had the Vietnam War start up, and the Marines got into that one as well, suffered very heavy casualties in the years they were there. In fact, a second lieutenant who went to Vietnam was pretty much sure to get shot. Every once in a while, you'll meet one who didn't, but that's how bloody it was for the Marines. And then after Vietnam, there was an interlude. I guess you had Grenada come up, that short fight. Followed by the Gulf War in 1990-91, where the Marines played once again a major role and did lead that push up to Kuwait City through the Iraqi defenses. And then everyone thought they were done with things for a while. And then, what was it? 20 years later, you have Afghanistan. Marines went in there in a big way, and Iraq as well. So it seems that just when everyone thinks we're sort of done with fighting, you get more of it. And the Marines have always been ready for this to play a major role. And it's something maybe in some ways unique to the United States, I think.
What have been some of the most memorable experiences in your career as a Marine?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, one of the things I think for a lot of people is that probably when they have passed the test to actually be a Marine, an officer, enlisted, whatever, you know, to get that commission, to the Eagle, Globe, and Anchor, you know, to be qualified, you know, to be entitled to call yourself a Marine. I think that is in some respects one of the highlights for everyone. That alone is, at least how I looked at it. One of the more interesting events that I experiences that I had was I lived in Japan for many years, of course. And at the end of when I was about last few years, I worked with the Japanese military to help them create an amphibious force. It was interesting, and you knew it was worthwhile. And what we were trying to do was to give the Japanese the capability to better defend themselves, to be a better ally to us, that we could actually work and operate with more effectively. And for me, the satisfying part of this is it was thought impossible by people who really knew Japan, that the Japanese just will never do this, that they couldn't possibly have an amphibious force. And even on the U.S. side, there were people who doubted it. But it showed what was possible. And I would note that I grew up with stories of the River Kwai camps from my father and others. So it was always, it was very interesting, if not ironic, that I would spend so much time in Japan working with the Japanese military to help them improve their defense capabilities. But it's a different Japan. It's not the same place it was 80 years ago. And that's the nature of things. It's a responsible, respected country where, with human rights, where people are treated decently, have all the freedoms that Americans take for granted. And now they're really a fundamental ally in defending the idea of freedom in the Pacific. And I think most nations are glad to see the Americans and the Japanese closely together. So I have some, that's probably, those are the two things, was actually passing the test and then to be called a Marine and then to actually help the Japanese improve their capabilities and their self-confidence at the same time.
So passing the test, you're referring to boot camp or the basic, the officer training?
In my case, it was the officer selection course and otherwise it would be boot camp. And it's basically...
So you didn't have to go through boot camp. That was for enlisted.
Well, it's basically the same thing, but with one big difference. And yes, boot camp in Paris Island and Camp San Diego, that's for the enlisted. But the officers go to Quantico for officer candidate school. And the big difference is that officer candidate school, they wanted to get rid of you. They wanted you to quit because you only want people who can sort of handle things. And if there's a weakness, you don't want them. You don't want to put them in front of enlisted Marines.
What did they do to make you want to quit?
Oh, well, they're not nice.
State secrets.
The thing is, it's not that big a surprise. They're just not nice to you. You know, you don't get, it's not like anyone says, well, I see that you have 3 master's degrees and speak blah, 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 and can do math. No, they're not nice in any respect. And you don't get much sleep. The food is sometimes minimal. There's really nothing relaxing about it. And you do have to perform well in certain exercises to pass it all. But physically, it's a challenge. And that's the idea, because you can convince yourself that you've got better things to do. That, you really didn't want to do this. So you have to have actually some mental toughness as much as the physical toughness as well. And I think it's probably been similar forever. I think some people say it used to be harder. Others will say it's easier now. I think it's never been a picnic. And I think it's still pretty tough. But that was the interesting thing, is they wanted to get rid of you. And people who show up at Marine Corps Officer Candidate School, it's not like you just wandered in, see what it was like. These are people who were ready for it. And yet in our group, about half did not pass. And that's, I think, not uncommon. I'm not sure what it is these days.
What did the other half end up doing?
Oh, you go back to whatever, you know, you go back to school, maybe you go back to work. Mm-hmm. Everyone does something else and go work for the government, private businesses. But just to show up at the place, that's a pretty daunting thing. And it's there's some, I think online there's some, YouTube, I think there's some sort of films of it, give you a sense of things. But that was, I think everyone, you find when Marines get together, sometimes they'll actually talk about their experiences at OCS or boot camp or wherever.
And boot camp, you know, Paris Island and the San Diego, there's competition there too, isn't there?
Oh, yes. The people who went to Paris Island claim the West Coast Marines are not quite up to the same standard. And then I think the people from San Diego think the ones who went to Paris Islands are nuts. but San Diego, the training ground, it's within sight of San Diego and San Diego Airport. So you see all these signs of civilization while you're being tormented. And whereas at Paris Island, you're in the middle of the swamps, basically. So you don't have as many distractions. But it is more humid and there's more insects than in California. If I had a choice, I would probably have taken San Diego.
More temptation just to test yourself?
Oh, just because it's not as humid, fewer mites and mosquitoes. That's why. Not for the temptation, it's better weather.
So you mentioned your parents. So are you a military brat?
No. We don't have a... there's not a tradition of military service in my family. I think I am sort of directly related to General George Crook, who was famous for fighting the Indians after the Civil War. But in between him and me, I think there's not a whole... there's been people, but it's not a tradition. It's not as if anyone says, well, you're a man now, join the military. You always, like a lot of people my age, you always had an interest in the military, and things just sort of came together to give the Marines a try. We do see ourselves as ultimately defending really a country that all sorts of people want to come and live in, which speaks for itself.
You wrote this book, When China Attacks, even when there's a showdown. What gives you confidence that the United States can come out ahead?
Well, we've been in bigger fights before. It seemed for a while, in fact, that the Japanese were going to beat us. And then look who won. And everyone talks about fighting to the death. Well, the Japanese were the only ones who actually did it. And at the end of those fights in the Pacific, there were not many prisoners taken. That was in part because the Japanese didn't surrender, but also was exceptionally ferocious fighting. I say America and free people and this idea of the United States, this human freedom, that is what we're defending. And you will do anything to preserve that, not to let it be snuffed out. And I say, we have seen this before. You know, at the Siege of Vienna, the Turks thought they had it won, and then suddenly the Poles came. So I look at it really as an idea that is being protected. And that is, once again, the idea of freedom. That is ultimately what the United States is all about. And so it's not as if we're the only people to ever undergo these challenges, these trials. And I like to think that we've still got it in us. And if you, you know, hang around the Marines, and even go to the, you know, I'll even say go to the Army, go to the Navy, the Air Force, when you see them on operations, and you have to be very impressed. But there is more that we can do, say, to make up for having sort of taken our eye off the ball longer than we should have. So I'm, you know, I understand the risk, and I think it's important that we don't underestimate it. But at the same time, you know, others have had bigger challenges to deal with than we did. And, you know, we've got a good hand to play, particularly if we stop funding the economy, the Chinese Ponzi scheme economy. That gives us a huge advantage. And the Marines at the Chosin Reservoir, they must have had a few doubts for a while. But if you could fight your way out of there, you'd think the other side would have some second thoughts about trying to stop us.
That's a very good point, a very good place to end our conversation.
Okay.
Thanks very much, Colonel.
Well, I appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity.
The Chosin was special because of the forces that we were in opposition to outnumbered us 10 or more to one. We were just overwhelmed with Chinese constantly around us. That was how many of them there were. You couldn't look across a field without seeing a Chinese body. And we fought our way out. We overcame the might of the Chinese army. We won the war. What more can I say?
We won the war.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
We outfought the Chinese. We escaped. They had us surrounded, and we fought our way out. And then we fought our way back, and we pushed them out of North Korea.
South Korea.
Or South Korea, yes. They just ran out of power to do anything with us. So many of them froze to death. More of them froze to death than died in combat. And I had my 18th birthday in boot camp.
Paris Island?
Paris Island. Is there any other?
Stanley, it's an honor.
Thank you. I'm proud of my Marines. Because without them, I wouldn't be here. And without me being here, they wouldn't be here. Just that simple.
We finally, and I say we, my battalion fought all the way down this road from Taktong Pass, and the 7th Marines became the rear guard for us, and we took the point, 3rd Battalion took the point to get back to Haggeru Ri, fighting all the way until we got about, 12, 13 miles from Haggeru Ri. And then finally we had little opposition from the Chinese. Just before we got to Haggeru Ri, and I arrived in the truck on the 3rd of December at Haggeru Ri. And I left the truck and positioned myself on the northwest corner at the intersection of the road going to Udamni and Haggeru Ri, right at this point. And in the afternoon of the 3rd of December, there was a group of 7th Marines from the rear point that was joining us at Haggeru Ri. And the commander of the group said, "We're not coming in here like a ragtag group. We're coming in here like Marines." And he called them to attention made them do a right face and to march at attention forward, march. And they marched about 25 to 50 feet from me. And he was counting cadence for them. You know, well, cadence count, 120 beats a minute. And someone in the group started singing the Marine Corps hymn. And I was close enough to him, I could hear his commands, and I could hear that voice singing the Marine Corps hymn. And within just a few seconds, the entire group started singing the Marine Corps hymn. And I got a shiver down my spine, because these men had been fighting 7 days and seven nights with little or no sleep, little to no food. They ate the Tootsie Rolls that were dropped. And they were now singing the Marine Corps hymn after fighting for 7 days and seven nights. You imagine someone singing, but they were singing, and I heard it. I was there. I was close enough to hear what they were saying, what they were doing, and I was emotionally involved.
Did you cry?
I didn't cry, but I was shaking from the cold and from the emotion of thinking about it. Some of these guys had to fight hand-to-hand combat.
I was wounded first in the left leg with my ankle blown out. I pulled myself into some rocks and then machine gun fire into the rocks from the enemy caused one round to ricochet and hit me in the spine. I was temporarily paralyzed from the waist down, which was good in one way because I had no feeling in the left leg where the ankle had been blown out. Later during the night, we were hit again with mortar fire and got shrapnels from that, and my legs also exposed at that time. So shortly after that, the enemy attacked again with the idea of coming in and killing the wounded by bayonet and the bodies. And that's when hand grenades started coming in our direction. And so I was wounded again, a matter of 13 wounds during the 4 to 5, 6 hours that I was laying there in the freezing snow. But the snow too and the coldness was a blessing in disguise because it caused the blood to freeze. Otherwise I would have bled to death. So I can't be too harsh on the cold winter. It actually ended up doing me a favor. At that point, I was picked up shortly thereafter when the enemy retreated, and people come by. I heard voices thinking, okay, this is it. That's the enemy voices I'm hearing. And they're coming to bayonet all the wounded. So I was getting ready to go see God. But at that point, it turned out to be Americans coming and picking up the wounded. And they carried me down and put me on a truck very similar to the one I'd been loading earlier in the day with the dead bodies. So I was thrown in a truck with dead bodies as well. Later in the morning, they were unloading the bodies, and when they came to me, they said, hey, this one's alive. I was moved out to the hospital ship USS Consolation. There I was lifted up over the rail of the ship, taken into operation fairly quickly. And as they lifted me over the rail on the ship, there was a nurse, an American nurse, someone I thought was the most beautiful angel in the world. Having been frozen, shot at, killed, almost killed, I've always remembered that woman